You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
So I'm Sarah Prey. I'm a senior policy analyst here in the OSF DC office. And I'm going to be the moderator for today's brown bag with Vonda. I wanted to call this Pirates, Pimps, Diamonds, and Drugs because I think that's a little bit sexier than maybe the title that we decided upon, but maybe a little too sensational. But we are going to be talking about Vonda's work as an Open Society Fellow. For those of you who don't know Vonda, she right now is in the middle of her fellowship with OSF. She works for the Brookings Institution. She's looking at illicit economies in East Africa, and she's recently come back from Kenya, Djibouti, Ethiopia, and Somalia. And she's looking into illicit economies that include logging, mining, poaching, human trafficking, drug trade, piracy, among them, and is looking at how these illicit economies intersect with violent conflict, social strife, terrorism, etc. When just looking at a couple of the recent statistics about illicit economies, and I'd be curious to hear if these are true or not, you know, one estimate said that the illegal economy accounts for somewhere between 8 to 15% of the world's GDP, which the implications for open societies are very clear, right? That distorts local economies, it undermines government, encourages corruption, facilitates money laundering, jeopardizes public health, undermines communities' ability to live freely and fairly. So, it's very relevant for our work here at OSF. So I think I'm going to turn it over to Vonda. She's going to talk a little bit about her trip, about her work, and then we will open it up for questions. But we're thrilled to have you here, Vonda. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you very much. The work in Africa that I will talk about, that Sarah described, is part of a larger book on how best to manage seven illicit economies. A key thrust of the book is to look at policy effectiveness, what works in managing, not suppressing, these illicit economies. But it's very much informed by the notion that although illicit economies pose a variety of very severe harms to states and societies, they often also are the key survival mechanism for some of the most underprivileged, most marginalized populations in the world. And in fact, their economic survival, their physical survival, and any form of social mobility can be directly dependent on the illicit economy. And that creates some extraordinarily difficult dilemmas, including in the case of Africa. I'll talk about what a policy regulatory nightmare it is for something like poaching and wildlife trafficking, and why that is fundamentally different from something like the drug trade. So the book is not about Africa per se. It does a comparative analysis for essentially each of the illicit economies. It looks at different parts of the world. So logging is compared and explored in East Africa, in the Amazon, in Southeast Asia. In each place, you have essentially different dynamics and different implications for optimal policy regulation. The wildlife trafficking chapter, for example, looks at different bifurcated markets between East Asia and Africa. So each of the chapter does its own comparison, the piracy one, West Africa, East Africa, Southeast Asia, etc. But let me talk about the East Africa field work. I was there for about 3 months. Spent time in Ethiopia, Djibouti, Kenya, and Somalia. Both Somaliland as well as Mogadishu and the Merca sector, essentially, of Somalia. And I was looking principally at five illicit economies, which was illegal logging and charcoal smuggling, the drug trade and drug trafficking, so both looking at illicit drug markets in the region, as well as the legal market in Kat or Chad. Human trafficking, and that morphed, extended as a result of the research into looking more broadly at prostitution markets in Africa, and brought out some fascinating, very surprising, fascinating findings, wildlife trafficking and maritime piracy. But I also have these two secondary interests of mine, and one is to look at urban gangs around the world. So I was looking both at the Kenya slums and urban gangs there, and Ethiopia, and why there are very few or no urban gangs in Ethiopia. And that ended up being some of the most fascinating investigative work I've ever done, and really surprising outcomes. And I hope a cute article coming out soon. And finally, I do a lot of my work on intervention in countries and stabilization counterinsurgency project. And so the Somalia research on piracy, logging, and smuggling also sort of translated into bigger research on what is happening with Somalia. That's very fascinating dynamics, arguably biggest security progress since 20 years, yet extremely fragile, and almost sort of exact parallels with the problems that Afghanistan is experiencing, either already acutely present or very much on the horizon. So I can talk about these issues in the question and answer period as well, if there is interest. But let me make some remarks about several of the illicit economies, and start with drug trafficking, which is getting a lot of attention with respect to West Africa. But a lot is happening in East Africa. There are, in fact, flows of heroin quite a bit from Asia and Middle East or to Middle East. There are cocaine flows increasingly emerging, as well as meth production and meth trafficking. And it is only a matter of time before the drama of the drug trade in East Africa becomes the drama of West Africa. Now, what is also apparent there is very much of a state elite complicity in and arguably capture of most of the illicit flows. Will that stay that way forever be questioned, or will there emerge contestation among other trafficking groups trying to challenge the current elite capture? Will be a determinative fact of how violent and visible the drug trafficking will emerge. The traffickers are not terribly sophisticated, but nonetheless, you see the emergence of people from non-elite, non-political dynasty backgrounds entering the drug trafficking trade, using the drug profits to build political capital and become elected members of parliament. Sonko, who just became the senator for Nairobi, is sort of your classic equivalent of the Escobar times. Well, he's more gentle than Escobar. He's not as violent, but of the sort of self-startup drug trafficker using drug proceeds to hand out goodies to poor communities and mobilize political capital. And he's been accepted by the Kenyan elite, and is in fact not just tolerated, but quite sought after. You know, again, how much that will emerge, how much these new drug lords entering the political system will be accepted into the political system or start challenging it, will be one of the factors determining how relatively peaceful or violent that market will become. There is also growing local consumption. It's still fairly small. It's very atomized. It's very much sort of lower level peddlers distributing drugs, and there's still far more consumption of marijuana, far more use of marijuana, for example, than hard drugs. But it's likely to change over time as well. The cut trade is very interesting, and it's very interesting because in some ways it can be conceived as a preview of legalizing marijuana markets. Cut is legal in the region, and is both consumption and production are legal. And the production takes place mainly in Ethiopia and Kenya, but consumption takes place throughout, particularly in various Somali, Ethiopian communities, also in Djibouti. It's very much dominated by either outright monopolies or key traders. It's a major source of income for farmers in Kenya and even farmers in Ethiopia. Lots of the trade itself then comes to be dominated by very influential businessmen who have great effect on how the drug, about how the narcotic is regulated or not. It's not very much at all penetrated by organized crime groups.
And how is it regulated?
Well, there is state regulation that essentially gives license, or in some cases not even a license, but areas are permitted to cultivate, and there are essentially geographic effects as to who can cultivate cut. But nonetheless, you have a variety of social problems associated with the economy, with the cut economy. One is huge drainage of water. And it's sort of acute and chronic and terrible in Yemen. You don't have that same level of effects in Kenya or Ethiopia, but you will, because these countries are drying up. There's a sort of confluence of factors why desertification is taking place, and cut is a very, very thirsty plant. And the state regulation has not been really capable of dealing with these environmental impacts at all. Another significant issue is, especially in places like Somalia or Djibouti, abuse of the narcotic to the effect that it really significantly undermines and weakens social capital and social structures, family structures. So come 1 o'clock in both Djibouti and Somalia, everyone is, all the mills are essentially stoned and useless. And the entire country and economy shuts down. No one can get anything done because everyone is high on cut. But then you have, one of the very interesting dynamics is this has allowed women in Djibouti to get divorces in the context of an Islamic society that they would otherwise never be able to have. So on the one hand, you can say, well, cut is a mechanism of liberation for women. But of course, what's underlying that is that the males become so indebted that even when the woman is left alone with several children, the man not only not at all contributes anything to the economy, but is to anything to the family income, but it's such drainage on the income of the family and produces such heavy indebtedness that even the state has recognized that they need to allow divorces. So you're having this sort of big social unhealthy impacts of real abuse of the drug. And it's interesting to see how that is happening far more in Djibouti and Somalia than in Ethiopia. Because in the case of Somalia, you have this extremely traumatized society, obviously very susceptible broadly to abuse. Whereas there is more of a sense that things are happening in Ethiopia. It's an authoritarian country, totally authoritarian country, but it's authoritarian in a way that still promotes growth and economic development that is absolutely unprecedented in Ethiopia's history. And so there is a lot of chewing of cut in Ethiopia, but the intensity of abuse and negative effects on society seem to be much milder and much more constrained than in a place like Djibouti or Somalia or Yemen, for that matter. And then you have other sort of interesting dynamics. So people often make the argument, locals make the argument, you know, we have some sort of fight with a rival. And in the morning, we are about to shoot them. And then come 1 o'clock, we start chewing cut together. And then we become friends. And when the night is over and we a little bit sober up, well, we get into a fight with them again. But by the time we would be drawing the weapons, we start chewing all over. So they make an argument that it is essentially the social interaction of the cut chewing that reduces some forms of violence.
Conflict resolution.
Right. I mean, I'm not persuaded that it really holds, that it holds sort of blanket, right? Because look at Somalia, it's one of the most violent, strife-torn countries with extraordinary rates of use and abuse of cut. But there are definite social dynamics associated with the chewing that can be, you know, that cannot be discounted to be fully negative. Or that right? Interesting. So, but. It's an interesting market, and there is a big debate in Britain, where cut in the United States is illegal. It's also smuggled here a lot because of the size of East African communities. Mm-hmm. In Britain, it's been legal, and it's there's been big push to make CAD illegal in Britain, and it's essentially lobbying by women, by females from East Africa, facing the same problems that that women in East Africa have. That the male abuse of CAD leads to such family indebtedness that the male is detrimental to the family. And so there's a lot of immigrant women pushing for making CAD illegal. It's a big debate in Britain. And an easy one, there is a lot of fear that if the trade becomes illegal, that will then enable organized crime groups to capture the trade in a way that's not been the case. Let me now switch to wildlife trafficking. And I was emailing a bit with Steve from Africa, and I sent him this line: drugs are easy. You should see how hard it is to come up with any good regulatory policy with respect to wildlife trafficking. And he sort of said, well, only you can get away with saying something like that. And the reason why wildlife trafficking is just so acutely and difficult to manage and deal with is because you have big penetration by organized crime groups, but still at the end of the day, the poachers or spotters, the people who actually find the animals or shoot, are often extraordinarily poor people. At the level of poverty in some of these desert countries that greatly surpasses even the poverty level for, say, cocaleros. Really, really poor people who essentially have no option, who exist in condition where there is not even any subsistence farming possibility because it's dry desert or very dry savanna. Yet at the same time, because of the explosion of demand markets in China and East Asian community and much more affluent population, the rate of poaching has just multiplied. It's extraordinary. In fact, we are seeing collapses of species at the rate that many biologists believe that if in 10 years 50% of current wildlife is left in East and South Africa, it'll be a lot. This is sort of the catastrophic rate of collapse that we are facing. And there are many factors, but poaching is absolutely critical and driving factor for very sensitive species, very endangered species. Most iconically rhinos and elephants, but a whole variety of other wildlife products are being shot and consumed. So, you know, what do you do about it? Well, in the late 1990s, there became a mantra for conservation folks that there are two solutions or two elements of a solution. One is you want to get the community involved so that the community has a stake in conservation. And the second was ecotourism can be the source of alternative livelihood for these poor families that are dependent on poaching or that participate in poaching. And I'm very sad to report that my work essentially debunks the blanket statement. I would not discount I would not say that it never works, but it only works under some circumstances. So for ecotourism to generate sufficient income for poor farmers, you first of all need the savanna and you need big animals. So that might apply well in East Africa, but it's not usable in West Africa where you have to trot through, slug it out through a rainforest for days and days to see a monkey. There's very few general ecotourists who will do that. So some of us will be willing to do that and will be very excited, but the amount of people who will come for such a project is limited. But even in the happy East Africa, big mammals, big open savanna, easily visible, big iconic animals, the vast majority of the money generated by ecotourism, which is enormous, by the way, is captured by either elites or lodges or the safari companies. Extraordinarily little trickles down to communities. A lodge that devotes 6% of their profits to something like community conservation issues is extraordinary. 6% to devote is extraordinary. So you have some of the richest families in Kenya, Tanzania, that capture the vast majority of the profits. Very, very little gets to communities. So, you know, the regulatory system that manages ecotourism needs to fundamentally break the structures and monopolies that exist within the political economy. Otherwise, it doesn't work. It just doesn't get to the community. The second notion that, it's extraordinarily difficult to pull off for essentially forest areas, where you have rainforest and small mammals, not big dramatic mammals, very easily visible. And the second is the notion that community management per se leads to good outcomes. Yeah, I'm very much a firm believer that the community needs to have a stake in conservation. That implies that the community needs to be able to develop, to derive economic benefits from conservation. Because both in Asia and in Africa, nature is seen fundamentally through consumptive view. The notion that, oh, isn't it wonderful to see a zebra, a highlight of my life, is not there. They see zebra every day until they die out. And the sense is, well, how will I eat? How will I buy myself the cell phone, the iPhone? The zebra only exists, well, I only have an interest in supporting the existence of the zebra if it impacts on my material life. So communities will very often privilege very short-term maximization of money at the detriment on long-term sustainment. Interestingly, in Kenya, you have some areas that are managed by Kenya Wildlife Society, which would be the equivalent of our national parks, mm-hmm. and some that are managed by communities. Overwhelmingly, those managed by communities are far more corrupt, far more poaching, far worse habitat than those managed by the state national entity. And even the state national entity is not doing well. In fact, one of the things that is striking and extremely disturbing is the increasing rates of corruption among the among park rangers in general, whether at the community level or at the national level. And in a place like Ethiopia, you essentially have no enforcement. You have one brave park manager somewhere, you know, slogging it out against the state, against the poachers, against the community, against the business interests, but he'll be one isolated individual in a essentially sea where anything goes. And I have increasingly come to believe that for many of these places the only solution is direct financial transfer of money to people, not to poach. That is very difficult and very problematic. You are essentially paying people not to engage in illegal and bad detrimental behavior. It can also only work if you have law enforcement that's good enough to be able to identify and punish those who take the money and still violate it. That presumes a law enforcement that is not corrupt. You don't have it essentially in any of these countries. But this notion that ecotourism is a way out, I don't think can hold. And if we pin our hopes on that without being far more specific under what circumstances it works, we will really end up in a situation where 10 years down the road, we'll be happy if there is 50% of current wildlife level. And by the way, for those of you who follow the drug debate, you know, you think that the debate about legalization as a solution or not is sort of tough and ideological. Should see the viciousness and doctrinaire, ideologically religious-like debate in the conservation field about whether legal supply should ever be allowed or how it should be allowed. So there's a lot of pressure by some groups, including very prominent conservationists, to say there should be legal sales of rhino horn. Rhinos die naturally. Many countries have accumulated the horn. We should sell it on the legal market to wipe out the illegal market. Same with ivory. And on the other hand, you have people who absolutely believe this is the greatest evil and heresy that can completely exist. And it's extremely complicated. Because you, in some conservation cases, like crocodilians, legal supply really wiped out the illegal market and saved the genera, or saved several of the species within the genus. Some species were actually directly wiped out as a result of legal farming in Asia. But in the current system, that there are periodic legal sell-offs of either ivory or horn, or for that matter, other wildlife product, there is a huge amount of laundering of illegally sourced products into the legal one. And it makes law enforcement that's already corrupt, already ineffective, far more difficult, because people really have no capacity to distinguish between the legally sourced and the illegally one. And even more dangerously, it makes it extremely difficult to manage demand and suppress demand, which really is key to conservation success, is to wipe out demand for wildlife products or significantly reduce demand for wildlife products. And so these legal sales periodically then lead customers to say, well, what you mean? Why shouldn't I eat, consume products with rhino horn, ground up rhino horn? It's being sold legally. And it's definitely pushing demand up. The question is how much it is pushing demand up, and it's hard to measure, and we don't have the data. I think this is where studies need to go. How much is the legal supply upping or preventing the decreases in demand? But you have very, very complicated effects of the legal economy, certainly not eliminating either organized crime or the illegal economy, and perhaps complicating it. But I still stick to the notion drugs are easy, because drugs essentially, you can take the attitude toward drugs, we'll just let cultivation happen. And we'll use law enforcement to shape where and how cultivation takes place and where and how trading, trafficking takes place. You cannot take the attitude with wildlife, because there won't be anything left. It will be gone very, very quickly. So drugs are easy, wildlife trafficking really hard. Same essentially unhappy story on illegal logging and charcoal production. I picked East Africa because it's a very different logging market than what's happening in the Congo or what's happening in Brazil, for example. And I wanted to have this contrasting case where the trees that are being stripped are these savanna desert acacias. And they are being used not for timber or for that matter for land, which is where a lot of deforestation takes place in Brazil, or in the Amazon broadly and in East Asia, but for charcoal smuggling. And it's or charcoal use. Essentially, logging is illegal without permits in that region, but charcoal production is legal. So what ends up happening is that people cut the tree illegally, whether with the connivance of authorities or not, and make it into production and make it burn it in the kilns for charcoal. The charcoal is consumed domestically in these countries, again by some of the poorest populations in the world. For them, it's the principal energy supply for a family is charcoal burning. It is also a luxury good for Middle East, where the most desirable acacias are used for barbecues in the Middle East. So you have this sort of two bifurcated demand market, both local poverty-driven demand and luxury good demand. And it's just stripping any coverage from Eastern Africa at fairly catastrophic rates, with sort of miles and miles of roads covered with these big charcoal bags. Governments in Ethiopia are almost totally apathetic with respect to any form of enforcement. In Kenya, they occasionally get a little bit more motivated. The key issue is, can you somehow change the demand markets? And in many of the poor population, consumers will make the argument that nothing is as cheap as the charcoal, and that kerosene or gas will cost twice or three times as much. That often is the case, but not always. And when you get to areas where all the acacias are gone, like parts of Ethiopia, the charcoal will become so expensive that it becomes competitive with other energy products for the family. Now, at that point, you also have no acacias left. Right, so you don't want to be in this regulatory position, because you lost your regulatory effort essentially when it equals out. So you can imagine scenarios such as subsidizing alternative fuels. Again, it has to be coupled with enforcement that people don't still cut it and don't still use it, and it's so extremely widespread. That is a huge regulatory enforcement headache, because just about everyone does it, including middle-class families in urban environments. They still burn with charcoal. So major headache. Then the question is, can you legally source it? And there have been various efforts to make charcoal out of eucalyptus that grows fast. It's a nasty plant, but it grows fast and you don't liquidate the natural habitat to the same extent. And so I interview lots of the kiln, people who operate the kilns, and saying, why don't you make it out of eucalyptus? And they claim that it doesn't burn well, that it burns very quickly, it explodes, and people don't want to buy it. They want to buy the hardwood acacia charcoal, not that. So it's a difficult switch to make. More interestingly, there is legally produced cut charcoal in South Africa, where acacias have overgrown habitat to the extent that from conservation perspective, it was desirable to reduce the amount of acacia overgrowth. And that could be something that I am very much exploring with some UN bodies. How could you at least direct that supply to the Middle East, to at least cut down on the Middle East, on the side of the Middle East demand driven for East African consumption. But it gets tricky because it's still more expensive than the illegally sourced acacia charcoal. And you have consumers in the Middle East that are the opposite of green. They have just no environmental consciousness, whatever. So it's a long slog. But the UN approach has been to ban charcoal, especially because Shabab and various other Somali militias make so much money on charcoal smuggling. I don't think it works because no one has the capacity to enforce it. So I think that the ban is at best futile, perhaps increasing interest for organized crime groups to penetrate it. Let me say a few words about piracy, which is very interesting because it gets into some very tough human rights dilemmas. So there's been a significant suppression of piracy off of East Africa. And it's very hard to nail down why this has happened. You have a confluence of different aspects of policy. And to attribute causality or percentage of causality to any of them is excruciatingly difficult to do. But nonetheless, you have far greater law enforcement on the water, on the Somali waters, on the Indian Ocean broadly waters than has been the case until 2007. There are armed guards on the ships, very problematic and controversial from a human rights perspective, and they're shooting at the pirates. They're killing the pirates. That has nonetheless physically resulted in ships being safer and not so easily overtaken. And then you have armed citadels, which are these kind of bunkers that are constructed on the ships. If the ship comes under attack, the crew retreats into that, calls the patrol, and the patrol then responds to the ship. So it buys time for the ship to respond, for the patrols to respond to a ship being under attack. This makes a big difference because prior to the prevalence of these citadels being on the ships, the pirates would take a ship over in like 7 minutes was the average time. So it was close to impossible then for the patrol to respond within that time, given the space. But the citadels really changed the dynamic. And finally, there is action against pirates on land, both in Kenya, where the pirates would be moving around and expatriating money to or sending money to, but also in Somalia, in places like Puntland. Again, very controversial, and some of these internationally sponsored anti-pirate forces have very much of militia-like characteristics, are already being used as the personal presidential guard of the president of Puntland, a complicated story. But you know, here is the dilemma. Do you not take these, and I would posit that the rights of the human rights of the pirates are being violated, right? They're being killed and their prosecution is often really doesn't, cannot be called to be in any way, you know, due process. I mean, they are prosecuted. But the tricky with problematic evidence, the trick is that how do you gather evidence? They'll, well, if they it captures imminent, they dump weapons abroad, and they say, we're fishermen. You know, that majority of them are not fishermen. So they're prosecuted with flimsy evidence, because in the absence of that, you would not be able to prosecute them at all, and you have no deterrence effect whatever on the frequency of attacks. And so the key effort there needs to be to really teach the navies how to do how to gather material evidence to have more meaningful prosecutions of the pirates. Then you have countries like China, India, and Russia. India and Russia particularly, that essentially don't bother with gathering evidence, put the pirates back on the skips without food and water and let them die. How frequently that happens is no one, is everyone's guess. No one really knows, because there is no way to monitor it. But to the extent that any NGO or human rights group could get some satellite data and develop some capacity to monitor that, that would be highly desirable, because some of these stories are very brutish and very unpleasant. You know, that said, the pirates will themselves report that it has deterrence effects, that they are very afraid to rant or operate in areas that are patrolled by the Indians or the Russians, for example. And, you know, all that said, the decrease I should mention another aspect. One other fascinating dynamic and problematic dynamic is that with the tougher enforcement, the pirates have become far more nervous, twitchy, and far more abusive to the crew that they actually managed to capture. And so you're trading a same deal that anti-kidnapping forces often have to trade. You beef up enforcement, and kidnappers become far more abusive toward the hostages. And the same trends are taking place with the pirates. As there is tougher enforcement, less ability to get ransom, more liberation through raids of the hostages, the pirates have become far more abusive toward them than they have been, except in West Africa, where piracy is exploding, very little patrolling, hostages are being treated very well, released very quickly, but it's a function of the fact that there is no law enforcement. And so at some point, there will need to be made a choice. Do we care about the amount of piracy of West Africa? And are we going to pull assets from the East Africa territory? In which case, it's probably going to go up in East Africa, because structurally, the conditions and incentives for the pirates have not changed other than the presence of law enforcement. I think I have gone like way over my time. What the hell? How long have I been?
It's okay.
So, you know, let me end it here. And I am also glad to chat about urban gangs or their absence, how they behave, or human trafficking and prostitution markets. So, you know, just ask a question and I'll take it away with that.
Thanks, Fonda. So maybe I have a meta question and then maybe a couple of more pointed ones. But the meta question is, it seems like the tie that binds the illicit trades that you discussed is the fact that it is staffed by people who have no other options. That the reason that, you know, people are poaching or selling drugs or, you know, getting involved in illegal logging, et cetera, is because, you know, they don't have access to the licit economies, right? Mm-hmm. The access to job markets. But at the same time, you've talked about the lack of governance, the lack of development, albeit Ethiopia is a little bit of an outlier because they're great on economic development, but that isn't necessarily trickling mm-hmm. down. So from a policy point of view, where's the solution? Mm-hmm. Figure it out.
I was wondering where you were headed. Just sort it out for us.
Yes, right. So each illicit economy that I look at in the book is its own each chapter. And each chapter ends or will end with a set of policy implications and recommendations. And very broadly, I do believe that you need to, that a law enforcement element is inescapable and crucial. Then with respect to each of the illicit economies, the question is, how do you direct it? But there is a sort of deeper and far more difficult question: how do you get over generalized corruption of malaise of law enforcement that is so strong in many parts of the world? And, you know, I the book doesn't get into that. I mean, I can sort of offer my own takes of what can be done, what works under what circumstances it works. But it's a bigger question that essentially whether the economy is legal or illegal or whatever the regulatory systems is to some extent epiphenomenal or even just fully dependent on the capacity of law enforcement, the capacity and willingness of law enforcement to enforce anything. And so I say, you know, we, especially in the drug field, tend to be preoccupied and mesmerized with the notion that problems come from illegality. I would make the argument that you can have well-managed illegal economies and well-managed legal economies. And you can have really badly managed illegal economies and really badly managed legal ones. A part of that is the regulatory framework and how regulation gets defined and how regulation is or is not flexible. But the other part is, do you have law enforcement that does what it's supposed to do, that is to enforce the regulation? In many of these countries, you don't have, and there is no incentive for them to behave properly. So, you know, almost a separate question is, how do you get at this larger malaise of governance and corruption? But what you clearly don't want to do is to set up regulatory regimes that conflict with the incentives of interest of the many of the key stakeholders in the system, because then it becomes a completely impossible game. And to also add that, what the chapters will do and spin-off articles will do is look at, for example, wildlife trafficking, and I will say, okay, you know, here, under these circumstances, ecotourism can work. Under these circumstances, it's not likely to work. This form of community engagement is likely to produce desirable outcomes. In these circumstances, you might have to rely on direct financial transfer. Extremely controversial proposition. We'll also say that I do believe that hunting, legal hunting, should be allowed. Question is when and how is it structured and how is it? But I would never make the argument it should be no legal hunting, right? Again, it's a very, very controversial position. I mean, you think about the drug debate being vicious. Yeah, it's so crucifixion in some of these debates like on wildlife conservation. So I have absolutely no ambition, and I would say it would be folly to say here is a blanket set of recommendation that applies to all illicit economies, or for that matter, to, in every case, to illicit economy. In fact, the sort of big pitch takeaway of the book is that specificity matters, that what works as a regulation for one economy in one place may have completely different outcomes, effects in another place, and what you need to do is to base everything on local regulatory, to base regulation on local institutional and cultural settings. So, no, it's a cop-out answer. But no, I'm being serious.
Really.
I am being serious. Yeah. You know, the search for the one or set of silver bullets just does not work.
Agui, you have a question?
I had a question about the piracy, but I just wanted to, I don't know, that's so interesting, and I like your formulation. I suppose I find myself kind of retreating, though, to the question of the broader governance failure. That, you know, if you're trying to solve problems, and the range that you have evoked in this few minutes that I've been here, sorry I came late by the way, you know, just seems to me that you'd be better off trying to figure out how to make that core set of propositions about the social contract between a government and its citizens and taxation and delivery of services work, in the hope of being able to even scale down, I mean, you won't eliminate, but scale down the kind of broader, the narrow issues you're trying to deal with, and then, you know, have them, as it were, within range. But at this point, to imagine how any, even with what you just said, which is so smart, that you must, you know, focus on the specifics of each set of circumstances, it's a losing game, it seems to me. I don't know, but that brings me to the question I wanted to ask you about the piracy, because, you know, the bit that I missed, if it's true that the circumstances have got so much tougher for pirates in Somalian, Kenyan waters, East African waters, and they are fearful of these consequences that you're describing, what has that done to the level of incidents? And
the incidence is dramatically down.
So it means that it's about the volume of inputs, or it's about the techniques that are being used to, in other words, how many people do you have to put in a boat and cast off and leave to die before you reduce the incidence? Or is it about policing the water and having a certain minimum number of people?
It's both. So the intensity of law enforcement has made a big difference. Now, you're still talking about extraordinary amount of water and space to patrol. But frankly, I am surprised, and I have to say I was wrong. I have argued 2 years ago that you can never deliver enough enforcement punch given the density of law enforcement, and I was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, I have to admit that. Now, what is very hard to pin down in this, it's just how much the effect is the citadel. I would still make the argument that the most effective of the set of policies that have changed is the citadels, the self-defenses that the ships now put on, as well as things like convoys. It makes a big difference if the ships go individually or whether they go in convoys. So there's a whole set of defensive measures that I would say made the biggest difference. But these defensive measures then are nonetheless linked to intensity of law enforcement. Because if there was no law enforcement, then you know, they could have three pirate skiffs taking a week to eventually starve them out, get them out of the citadels and take over the ship. So law enforcement makes a big difference. And that's why the policy is vulnerable to if there is a drop in law enforcement, because things seem to be looking so much better there as opposed to, for example, in West Africa, will it bring incidents down? Because the fundamental conditions and interests of the pirates have really not changed. They're down. And you have some interesting sort of tangling dynamics with tribal elders and pirates. Mm. But that too is complex. The pirates bring money into the local economy that they would not, that the economy would not have otherwise. They can be captured by politicians and elders and other interests. And for example, in one of the few little projects I had was interviewing pirates about how does one become a captain of the skiff? How do you become not just an ordinary, you know, are you most vicious? You know, do you have greatest capacity to shoot a gun? And the answer I got quite frequently was, well, if you are the son of these tribal elders, then you have privileged access to lands and ports, and then you're likely going to become a pirate captain. And so, you know, you see these fascinating dynamics in how existing structures of power are being reinforced and when they are being challenged. But incidence is dramatically down, and it's a function of better self-defense forces and greater law enforcement. It's not a function that the pirates have other options. I mean, they're chilling their heels right now, but they, you know, they're still very poor country. They don't have anything to do, really. If the sense is that it's less risky, I would posit that incidentally would go up again. And they really have nothing. I mean, there is this narrative that they could either be fishermen or that they are fishermen immiserated, deprived of fishing by the big fishing fleets. I don't quite buy it. I mean, there is tremendous amount of illegal fishing by these big fishing fleets. It's out of control and it needs to be enforced. And unfortunately, the anti-piracy patrols, navies don't enforce it, including because many of these fishing fleets are Chinese, are Indian, are European, and it's their primary business, very powerful, potent industries. But the reality is always that these pirates were never fishermen to start with. Many of them were not. And the bottom trawling that these big fishing fleets do that destroy the waters, it's not the kind of fish they would have been catching had they been fishermen, but they know. So they kind of lose use now, chilling their heels, living it up on the money they made, or not having money. And so should the level of enforcement change, there will be a lot of interest on their part to get back in the business, in my view.
Any questions in New York? Gene?
David and I were at a conference about 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago in Bulgaria about organized crime, and a guy who was with, I think he was in the European University, was studying trafficking, and he said that he was about to come to the conclusion that there were more people working with NGOs on trafficking in Europe than there were people being trafficked.
Human trafficking.
Uh-huh. I wondered what you thought of that. And is that true elsewhere in the world? If there's some truth to that, is that true in other places?
I don't know. But human trafficking has become an extremely, pardon the pun, sexy topic.
Right.
Everyone and their brother wants to be doing anti-human trafficking effort. And I'm delighted to see finally top levels of U.S. Government to sort of talk more broadly, including on some of these wildlife trafficking, where you had essentially a decade where all the talk was human trafficking and nothing else. My view is that lots of the policies that are being adopted are not terribly effective. Mm-hmm. And one is this sort of generalized information campaign for women that are potentially to be trafficked. And the campaigns go, you know, don't trust the man who tells you you'll become a model, he'll traffic you, right? And they are just not getting any traction, often. Even in places like Indonesia, when I was before, I interviewed some of the women who were trafficked, who were victims of trafficking, and they would be college educated, and they would still fall into this notion, we will make you a movie star, or we'll get you this exciting job in Thailand. And you, sort of, and you said, well, you know, did you ever hear these campaigns? Yes, yes, but we didn't pay attention to it, right? So the messaging, this blanket messaging, in my view, doesn't work, and there needs to be thinking about how do you change the messaging to get some traction. It's also true that there is, in Africa in particular, there is, as well as parts of Asia, there is huge family complicity in the trafficking.
And government complicity as
well. Government complicity absolutely as well, but also family. And so the portrayal of the traffic is this trafficker with the mustache somewhere on the side luring these women into. The reality is that they are very often sold by family members. And so, you know, how do you enforce that? How do you build any preventive measures? It's a very different proposition than don't go with the guy who promises you to become a movie star. Especially in Africa and Asia, it's very, very much of a problem, as well as government complicity with many police forces. In Indonesia, for example, the trafficking market, the human trafficking market, is essentially divided among different police / military units in different areas, and you really don't have very much outside traffickers at all. The domestic market anyway is dominated by different police forces units. Now, how do you start exposing that, cracking that down? Again gets to how do you get a generalized corruption within police forces? How do you identify as leaders that have an interest to behave differently and have a capacity to change anything and will stay enough in the system and not get pushed out and eliminated by the system? And there is this very difficult debate about prostitution, should it be legal or not, and how does that impact and feed into trafficking. And it's another one, this crucification debate, with people sort of being vehement believers that no legal prostitution should ever be allowed because it devalues women and set up these mechanisms where women can be trafficked. I think there's been some very interesting experiments, for example, in Australia, where legal prostitution has had very positive effects, both on the quality of life of the prostitutes, as well as on the sense that the trafficking overall was being reduced. But again, the context specificity, I think, is critical, and the level of enforcement and monitoring that New Wales and Australia could put up is likely something that cannot be achieved in other places. That said, a lot of the women that were liberated from being trafficked would end up as prostitutes voluntarily. And lots of the alternative livelihoods offered to them, becoming seamstresses, they had just no interest in. And they would say, no, you know, our best option is to be prostitutes. So here is where the East Africa research was absolutely fascinating. It's a tremendous amount of prostitution. Is very much, and in fact, you have women.
But no pimps.
No pimps. You have very many women that will have a job and still get paid for sex as part time, and some will work fully as prostitutes. But in Kenya, in Djibouti, in Ethiopia, I did not find a pimp. And when I would ask the prostitutes, you know, can I talk with the pimp? Who's your pimp? What's a pimp? They're like, well, that's the guy who you pay money to and he protects you. What? And it was absolutely extraordinary that you have this very atomized market that really lacks structures of organization in the market that my every expectation would be, there is a reason why pimps exist. You will not have a prostitution market without a pimp. And alas, there was just no pimp to be had, and no concept of what a pimp is. In fact, just no protection at all.
Is it to do with volume?
I wish I knew the answer why that is not the case. I think there are sort of structural, or there are cultural aspects to it, but I wouldn't push the explanation too far. The women are very vulnerable. They are vulnerable to customers not paying and abusing them, and they're very vulnerable to police. So you have, the police is not treating them any more mildly. They extort them, demand sex for free, put, you know, hold them in. So the very same reason why you have a pimp in Europe or the United States exists there, and you would expect that you would have the solution, but you don't. And so it was absolutely extraordinary that the market is so atomized, but clearly it's leaving the women vulnerable. In many illicit economies, I would say that an optimal outcome is a very atomized illicit economy that's as close to sort of free market with many, many little providers. In this case, I'm not sure that it's helping the women, frankly, in any way. Is it better for customers? Who knows, but it should not be the most important criteria. And certainly for the women, they are very vulnerable. And often they make also so little earnings very frequently that they have no capacity to escape from poverty, although there is great variation in the conditions of the women. Interestingly, there are also very few brothels. Very few. So you have these sort of individualized chains of getting customers. People, a prostitute will sort of develop a network, or perhaps hotels will recommend the prostitute, but it's a much looser arrangement, nowhere with the level of protection that an institution like a pimp or brothel would bring. And I would expect to win a great prize if I could answer why not. My expectation is that there are sort of cultural elements to it, and probably historically I would posit quite a bit of prostitution, extramarital sex in the village setting that has conditioned a sense that this is not such a special market that people should be interested in exploiting and building into structures. But, you know, I have flimsy evidence to make that argument, and I cannot say that I really resolved it and nailed it down. This is why you don't have pimps. But the other thing that was interesting, and I guess I'm guilty somewhat of moving beyond the sort of neutral observer to becoming an agent, when I was interviewing the women about do you have pimps or not, and explaining what a pimp is, many of them would react, wow, that's interesting, that's wonderful, we should really get one.
Unintended consequences, I suppose. I'm wondering about...
Was there a question in New York? I think
that was she's gone, oh. I think. It was hard.
Yeah. I had, hi Ivana, Christine. So I had a question actually, and I know that this was a bit tangential or peripheral to your work, but you spoke about this when you came back from Indonesia. You spoke about it again today, but this question of urban gangs, and you made that interesting comment about how there were very few, if none, that you were able to observe in terms of a presence in Ethiopia, but you did certainly see it in Kenya. And in Indonesia, I think you had also made a comment that it was a very strong subsection of the youth, I guess, in that country. So I was wondering if you had any initial thoughts as to how or why these differences are emerging in these different countries very much across the world.
So very interesting. In Indonesia, you have a lot of urban gangs. And what's fascinating about Indonesia as a country is that in many ways it was the pirate republic. The initial people who brought about independence were criminals and pirates. And from that moment onward, you have different levels of authoritarian and progressively democratic rule where the state controls criminals and uses criminals for its purposes. And that survives even the democratization. Even today, in the current 10 years of, more than that, 13, 15, I guess, of democracy, you still have key political actors and key political institutions exploiting urban gangs for their purposes. And what is amazing is that throughout these huge political upheavals, the state and politicians have managed to maintain control over the gangs, and the gangs have not broke out of their lord's reins and become independent and very threatening in the same way that you see in Mexico with drug groups more broadly, or that you see in places like Rio or Medellin, where yes, there is a degree of cooptation, but it's far more now on the terms of the gangs, and there's far more confrontation. Whereas in Indonesia, but as well in India, Nepal, you have very strong, effective political control of criminal actors, urban gangs exploited for the purposes of the state, but managing control. Now, contrast that with Kenya, where there is a lot of urban gangs, in Nairobi particularly, and they are quite ethnically based or clan-based, and they certainly have been exploited, particularly by the Kikuyu politicians like the Mungiki, but not just by the Kikuyu politicians, for the purposes of the state. That exploded on the politicians in the last election, not in the current one, in the 2007, where the politicians used the gangs to kill so many people that violence was triggered at a level that became very visible, and now both the president and the vice president are under indictment by the ICC. Then you have you have other non-Kikuyu gangs like the Lua gangs. Essentially, each ethnic community has its own gangs. What's very interesting about the gangs in Kenya is that they're both very unsophisticated. They're mostly remain at the level of extortion, some limited protection, but that protection is almost solely based against other ethnically based gangs. But they don't provide the same level of social public services and more broader protection that gangs, more sophisticated gangs in Latin America or Indonesia would, for example. And so they're quite, the community is only mildly supportive of them, but it's particularly politicians that explore them.
Do you count the MRC as an urban gang, or are they a different entity?
I would say they're gang, but you know, what's a gang? They can't be. What's a terrorist? What's an insurgent group? But I would make the argument that, well, they're more than just a gang. They also have a very clear sort of revolutionary political agenda that, I was about to say, that's like way more than, say, the Mungiki, but it's not even quite true, right? There is all this lingo and narrative, an ideological narrative on the Mungiki that's extraordinarily revolutionary, extraordinarily ideologically specified in a way that an urban gang in Rio will never have that level of ideology, but I would put the MRC in a separate category. They have more of a political expression than the others. But then you look at Ethiopia, and why are there no gangs? And so this became my sort of most interesting investigative work. That started with the fact that every time I would move outside of Addis, I would step out of my car, I would be accosted by young men who claimed that they are compulsory tourist guides. And say, you know, you want to go to this fish market, you have to pay an entrance fee, and on top of that, you have to pay us $20 so that we escort you around the fish market. And I would say, no, thank you, I'm not interested. They would say, well, you cannot go in. And so this became constant struggle and tussle and fight. And if I would take them, they would be useless. They would say, this is a fish market, this is a fisherman, this is fish, this is the woman who cooks the fish, $20. But if I wouldn't take them, then I would be deprived of this knowledge. More importantly, I would be mugged, harassed, pickpocketed at a far greater level, far greater extent than I had those characters. So as this was going on for, you know, second week into it, I was like, hold on. There is, you know, a systemic racket, structured racket going on, and they have IDs issued from the state. They are tourist guides, right? And so I got into doing, essentially hiring them, interviewing them, or not hiring them, sometimes kind of doing comparative cases. And it became totally obvious that the state, which is very authoritarian and has a lot of control over the country, is nonetheless identified as a key danger, this youth bulge that's emerging and not having any employment. And so their solution has been to generate the state organized crime alternative by diverting these young men predominantly to be tourist guides that are imposed on foreigners that are useless for anything other than you limit the amount of exposure, the amount of harassment that the foreigner gets. Now, it's these same people who organize a gang that will harass you if you don't hire them. So they run their own little racket of pickpockets. And so as I got to interview them more, some of them just totally told me, look, we were hustlers, we were a pickpocket. 3 years ago, the state rounded us up and said, you can go to jail or you can become a tourist guide. They became tourist guides, and many of them loved the state because they raked a lot of money off the West to turn tourists. I mean, they make far more money than they could otherwise have. And you see how these 20-year-olds will become community leaders and manage community money from ecotourism because of their this extraordinary privileged position as a tourist guide in communities that otherwise have nothing. But they look like gangsters, and you talk with them, how do you manage the funds? So you get 10% from ecotourism. How does the village, how do you divide the money? And most of the time it's totally blank. You know, it's pretty much they keep the money for their gold chains and iPhones and whatever. And in some cases it works better. I mean, there are some communities where there is much more of an investment of the money they generate personally or they are then in charge of. But in many areas, just totally eliminating previous structures and creating this new gangster-like elite who are tourist guides. Now, it's a brilliant policy on the part of the state, but its limitation is that at some point you will not be able to have enough tourists to be feeding the huge youth bulge that is entering the system. And the other key mechanism is that most of the tourists are not as uppity as I was, saying, no, I have no interest in hiring you and arguing with them. They'll just yield to a certain amount of pressure. But the key mechanism that the state uses to enforce this racket is that I cannot hire a car, I need the driver. I cannot drive myself. The drivers are under tremendous pressure from both the one party that rules the country as well as police to make sure that the foreigner will hire these useless tourist guides. And in fact, my driver would be terrified when I would refuse. I mean, he was terrified of the punishment that awaited him if I would not hire them. So, you know, the system of protection and extortion operates not simply at the level of the actual tourist guide, but it's sort of backup structures in the back of the state. And in fact, when I would sort of most protest and refuse to hire them or say things like, okay, the Minister of Tourism is my friend, I will report to you how you lied to me, because they would say that it's legally required to hire them, which it isn't. They just need to enforce it. What they would then do is to try to unleash the political party at me. So they would round up people from the local office of the political party and kind of, you know, try to go push me around until I yield it to them. So this is a brilliant scheme.
I think I speak for everyone that I want to go on vacation with you. Sounds like it would be pretty interesting. This was fascinating. I think I'm definitely interested to see the book. You did raise probably more questions than answers, but I think that you knew you were going to do that, right? This is just goes to show, I think, the work of the Open Society Foundations and, you know, how all these things are tied together and, you know, we can't work on one without the other. And, you know, I mean, you laughed at my question about how do we get at, you know, empowering youth and getting to the illicit economies, but I mean, that's what it's going to take, right?
That's a key component of it, anyway.
Okay, well, thanks to those in New York. Thank you so much, Manda.
My pleasure.
Really, really interesting. Have a great day, everyone.